Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today we have three bills that are on for public hearing. We also have informational meeting. This is the way we're going to do it. We're going to do the informational portion of the meeting first because what I want to have happen is make certain those who are going to be giving public testimony will hear that informational testimony. These are concepts that could be folded into one of the bills, and so you can comment on those when you give testimony. Because I have a number of members here who want to give testimony, we are going to allow them to testify first because they have other duties in the building. I also have know the state superintendent here, and she's on a tight schedule, so we will get her up in that same group as we go through that. Once we get through those individuals, then we'll take on the individuals that are here for informational part and that have been asked to come forward and give us concepts or their perspectives on some of the concepts. Then we'll open it up from there. And what we'll do is when we open it up for, and as far as I'm concerned, at this point, when we, all of the members can speak to any of the three bills or the concepts, same thing for the individuals that will be coming up and presenting during the informational part, and clearly for those who are coming here to give public testimony, you will be free to comment on any of the three bills at the same time. We're not going to run people back and forth, just efficiency of time. And also the concepts if you want to make any remarks. Due to the number of people that we do have here that want to give testimony today, we are going to be needing to limit it. It appears that we're going to need to probably limit to somewhere around 2, maybe 3 minutes per person, depending on what the actual numbers are. We'll work with it best we can. We'll see how many people we get on, and then we'll make other decisions if we think we haven't gotten through the list to the that people have signed up. So with that, let's go ahead and start off with the first panel. I'm going to ask Representative Krieger, Representative Barker, and Representative Thatcher if you three would first come forward. At 9:30. Okay, we'll, And colleagues, whoever wants to lead off.
Yeah, please. Chair Pavansky and committee members, for the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative from District 1. I want to start out just briefly a little bit about House Bill 2792, the reciprocity. There are something over 30 states that now recognize handgun concealed carry permits, which would allow those people to if we had reciprocity for Oregonians to go into those states and carry and do so legally, and also allow them to come into our state. The bill only is going to recognize those states concealed carry permit that are valid license permit that are issued in another state by that state local law enforcement agency, a court, or some other issuing authority that might be different than what Oregon has. There would be 4 or 5 states that don't have any licensing process, and under this bill, Oregon would not be recognizing those people's ability to come into the state. We've heard several times that there's a problem with possibly that the criteria of receiving a permit or the testing or qualifications are different. In fact, that is the case on many, many permits that state recognizes. The most obvious one is driver's licenses. Though they're similar, they're different, but the people have the opportunity to follow, come into Oregon with their driver's license or a truck driver's license, and we recognize that and don't question whether or not it's the same. We also recognize that the way the statute's written, that permit or concealed carry has to be on the person's on person. You can't say, you know, if you don't have it, you're in violation for not having that permit. Just what was, you know, there were 3 police officers on the Judiciary Committee in the House. There's about 90 years plus. I would contend, if you think about it, if we voted for these bills in the House after the discussions we've had over this issue for the last 10 years, none of us would have supported any of these bills had we thought there was any problem with them or that it actually had a public safety risk. There was no testimony from the state police, the sheriff's office, or the chief of police association in opposition to these bills. Again, if any of those organizations that represent those people, which are public safety, I would have assumed that they would have come forward and stated those, and they did not. Mr. Chair, do you want me to go on to the next bill?
Yes.
Okay. The other one was House Bill 2797, operating motorcycles and all-terrain vehicles. I go back to with the state police when I was with them in 1968 in Klamath Falls, when the first three-wheelers came online. And at that time, more so than on a regular two-wheel bike, the problem was that people were running game over in Eastern Oregon. What was strange to me, even at the time, I contend, what are you doing about a loaded gun on an ATV three-wheeler? Because it was already a violation of the law to hunt from a motor vehicle. So how we ever got here, and it was never done really for the purpose of public safety. If public safety were the issue, I would contend that we would have banned people from carrying while riding a horse. So that, to me, is not a valid issue, and I know the others will talk about that one, too. And, of course, the next bill, which is 2787, which would give the sheriff the right not to have to divulge the name of concealed carry. I think most of the people who have a concealed carry were under the impression that that was, in fact, confidential information. But after the courts looked at it, we find that it is not. And the sheriff had come forward a session or two ago, wanting to correct this. We did have a bill in the House that I believe, I can't recall if we got it to the Senate or not, but it didn't make it through the process. Representative Stigler had worked on it, not the rest of us, but I'm not certain what gain there is to the public or what gain there is to anyone to reveal those names. In fact, if I wanted to burglarize somebody's house, I could get a list and I could know who did not have a concealed carry. And I would be more have a tendency to want to go to that house if I'm going to burglarize it than then do a house that somebody has got a gun. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Okay, I'll go. I guess I'll just take the one that's on top of the file here, and it just has to do with guns on ATVs, snowmobiles, and motorcycles, 2797. And I think a couple of constituents or people that have written into me, not necessarily constituents, have written into me and summed it up pretty
Representative,
well.
Representative, could you state your name for the
record? Oh, I'm sorry. Kim Thatcher. I'm from House District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. I apologize for that. As if I'm testifying for the first time here. Okay, this is what he says. He says, I ride my ATV in the woods and in the eastern Oregon high desert where a loaded handgun would come in handy for rattlesnakes. Here's another. I am the owner of a quad. I ride far up into the mountains and I do carry a loaded handgun on my side. I didn't know until recently that it was against the law to do so. Things like bears, cougars, and humans that could cause me harm are out there. I would not have time to draw my weapon, load it, and try to protect myself. That's just plain crazy. I might as well pick up rocks and throw them. So, my family, we spend a lot of time out in the woods on four-wheelers, too, and it just needs some clarity in the law. There's some inadvertent. I think this is just a technical fix, because under current law, no one, not even someone with a concealed handgun license, can carry on an ATV or on a snowmobile. It clarifies the law, I think, in a couple ways. It clarifies the definition of readily accessible and the definition of unloaded. So and it fixes another area of the law that needs to be dealt with for motorcycles and allows for safe transport there. Now, on 2792, concealed handgun license recognition, Representative Krieger covered most of it. I just want to say that there's legal gun owners from outside the state who can and do already openly carry where legal in Oregon. And I believe that it's a logical next step to allow those who have gone through the steps to get a concealed carry permit to come into the state. Let's see. 2787, having to do with protecting the privacy of CHL holders. I think if we were talking about a permit to, if we had to fill out a permit to own a car, I don't think there'd be any hesitation from anybody that that information should be kept private. But because the subject matter is to carry a concealed handgun license, then suddenly the controversy ensues. And if you know, some of the information that's on these applications, and they vary slightly from county to county, keep in mind, but the kinds of information that are on these, you know, things like home phone numbers, home address, social security numbers, what kinds of guns you have in the house, whether you were dishonorably discharged from military and on, what controlled substances you might be taking, and the people who administer these records, the county sheriffs, have asked us to... for this legislation, because in recent years they've been forced by the courts to disclose these records. There are currently no protections, and this would fix that problem. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. And I'll keep this very brief since I don't want to be repeating the same things. As far as the reciprocity bill, it's good to remember that people who are applying for these concealed handgun licenses anywhere in America, for the record, Jeff Barker, State Representative of House District 28. First time in my life.
Great
life. Thank you. Yeah. But the people who are getting these licenses, even if their regulations are different, are the law-abiding citizens of the country, and they want to bring their handgun with them on vacation. And I just would point out that these are people who are not the problem. The law-abiding citizens are not the problem. The privacy of the records on the CHL, it doesn't tell you, if you were to get my records, it wouldn't tell you if I have guns or how many guns I have. And being a retired cop, I don't have to have a CHL. I'm allowed to carry, and I have whatever I have at my house is, you know, strictly private. So this protects people. This gives them the privacy. They signed up to get that because they don't want some of them. Probably don't want people to know that they have the handgun, that they're carrying it, and that's why it's concealed instead of strapping it on like Matt Dillon and wearing it on the outside of their clothes. On the ATV law, a person should be able to carry a handgun. I mean, originally I think that was intended for the hunters, but my elk rifle, and I use ATV when I'm up in the mountains, I don't have a magazine for it. I have to feed the bullets in one at a time. And so I have a handful of bullets when I get off, and I load it. But if I saw an animal and wanted to make a quick, be able to get off, get away from the trail and take a quick shot, I wouldn't be able to do it under the current law. And I obey the current law. I do not have that thing loaded. Under that law, it would allow me to have bullets in there, but not one actually under the hammer. And we even have somebody of Representative Krieger's age, in his youth, he probably had black powder, and so on a black powder gun, you can't have the primer in, so it's safe. They're safe. You have to actually take an action before you could shoot, and so that law just brings things into makes sense. And then one other thing that I don't know that you're going to probably talk about in general terms today is the gun checks and the OSP versus the federal NIC system. The state police are charging $10 a gun today. They want to charge $26. I paid my federal taxes last week, and I've already paid to have NICS do it. So I've already paid that, and they'll do it for no cost to me. State police, I think, told us in testimony they'll put in $9 million a year with gun checks. That's $9 million taken out of the Oregon economy from law-abiding, legitimate citizens purchasing firearms that could be used to buy groceries or anything else, or an electric car if you're so inclined. And so we've already paid that. I think it would be a good idea for us to move to the federal system. And if the state police stayed at $10, they claim it would cost them $4 million to run it out of general fund. We don't have that money to lose. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I'm going to open up the questions, but I'm going to caution you, they're probably all packing. No questions.
No, I have a question.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. I can't let them get away without any questions. I have to remember the number of the other state, rest of the reciprocity bill. Can you compare Oregon standards to get a concealed handgun license with the standards in other states?
Well, other states vary, and that was one of the topics that came up, and Oregon has, you know, you have to actually go out and do some shooting. Some states don't require that. But the main point I would make of that is the same as Representative Krieger said about, we don't know what driver's license requirements are, but we let people drive here. People who are applying for those go through the gun checks. I mean, go through their check for their criminal records and mental health records and so on. They're law-abiding citizens who are applying for those permits. And I think that, you know, and again, as Representative Krieger said, with the at least 90 years of law enforcement on our side in our panel, we didn't feel there was a problem with that.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. You.
All right. My next panel is going to be, I'm sticking with the members, Representative Nathanson, Senator Burdick, and Superintendent Castillo. And I don't believe, if there's any other members here, we did not catch you walking in, so just want to see if there's anyone else. Okay. And Superintendent Castillo, I understand you're on an extremely tight schedule. If you'd like to go first.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Castillo, the Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. I am very pleased to be here today to testify in support of a proposed concept that is before you to the firearms bill about guns in schools. As Superintendent of Public Instruction, I'm responsible for the leadership and general supervision of the 197 school districts that we have in our state. And I understand that the amendment that is under consideration proposes to make our schools the safe places that we all expect them to be by prohibiting concealed firearms and other dangerous weapons on school grounds. You know, I think most people already think that guns and weapons are not allowed in schools or on school grounds. Following the Columbine and Thurston shootings, the school community took a hard look at the safety of our schools, and as a result of those incidents, there was federal law, state law, and school policies that were strengthened. We have worked very hard to send a message to students and to teachers and the community that schools are safe places to be. We have a zero-tolerance policy when it comes to guns. We've worked hard to create a school culture that rejects violence and rejects weapons. But there's a loophole. Holders of concealed weapons permits may carry loaded guns into our children's schools. The amendment to the gun bill would works to close that loophole, and that just makes for common sense. Now, I am not anti-gun by any means, but we are talking about places where kids are, so we need to be thoughtfully cautious. Opponents, I know, will argue that we don't need this bill, that there has been no rash of school of shootings in our schools, but I think back to when the Thurston shooting happened, and we all asked, how could we have prevented this incident? What could we have done differently? And I don't want to wait until something happens involving a concealed handgun. So we need to be proactive, and we need to act now. Opponents will also argue that we have that they have a right to carry weapons anywhere, including our schools. Yet we already prohibit the carrying of concealed weapons at many public places, and employers may prohibit their employees from bringing guns to the workplace. So if Intel can ban concealed handguns in the workplace, shouldn't our school staff feel equally safe in their workplace? If the Portland Trailblazers can ban concealed guns, shouldn't high school basketball games be free of concealed guns as well? Why should we have a lower standard of safety for our school children than we have for the Portland Trailblazers and their fans? We spend a lot of time talking about improving schools and how to fund those improvements, and I know that you have this session. This proposal would cost nothing and would yield a big benefit. A consistent message to our kids that they mean the world to us, and we will do everything we can to keep them safe. Prevention of school violence is going to require multiple strategies. The intolerance of bullying behavior, which you have been addressing. The effective use of school resource officers. Buildings that are designed with safety in mind. And students who are educated as to how to resolve conflicts in nonviolent ways. The elimination of firearms in schools is just one strategy to provide the safest school environment possible. But because guns pose the most potential lethal risk, their elimination should be at the top of our list. Thank you for allowing me to deliver this testimony this morning.
All right. Thank you. Superintendent Castile, can you wait for the panel? Okay. Representative Nathanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13 in the Eugene area. I'm here to talk about guns and mental illness. There was a tragic incident in the Eugene Springfield area last week. A local law enforcement officer was shot and killed. A suspect was apprehended. And from newspaper reports that followed, comments about the suspect that were published, the community is starting to ask, how did this person, if that is indeed the person, how did this person come to have a gun and be able to use it? That person, from newspaper stories that my neighbors and others in the community have read, people are asking, it's clear that this person had mental health issues, serious issues, and they're asking me, and I'm wondering, and I think this is a perfect opportunity as you consider legislation about firearms to look at three different aspects of how our laws and the application of our laws might be working. First of all, are our statutes adequate to keep guns out of the hands of people who are mentally ill? The second aspect is procedures. Were all of the procedures adequate and were they followed? Procedures that need to be followed by the state or local officials. And finally, caseworkers. What is the role of caseworkers and other professionals who come in contact with people who are exhibiting mental illness, either ongoing mental illness or perhaps a sudden change in their behaviors and actions? What happens when a caseworker or other professional becomes aware of either the mental illness or the presence of a weapon? What is their responsibility? So I would just ask that you consider those three things: the statutes, following procedures, and the role of caseworkers. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Senator Burdick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for taking up these issues. I have opinions on all the bills before you and all the concepts, but I want to focus my comments today on the concept of banning concealed handgun license holders from bringing their guns onto school.
Need you to get your name on the record.
Did I forget? Okay. First time I've done that. Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, which is Southwest Portland, Tigard, and King City. My apologies. I want to focus my comments today on your excellent concept to keep all guns off of school grounds, both elementary, secondary, and college campuses. And I want to focus... Superintendent Castillo covered a lot of the points I want to make about why it's generally a good idea. But I want to focus on the issue of training and the fact that these people who have concealed handgun licenses do not go through the kind of law enforcement training that enables law enforcement officers to get into a school situation and de-escalate a crisis when it occurs. There are some who argue that CHL holders would be able to assist if a school shooting takes place, but the evidence indicates the contrary, that they are more likely to do more harm than good in such high-stress situations. An NRA or hunter safety course is nowhere near as comprehensive as the hundreds of hours of firearm training that law enforcement officials complete. In addition to rigorous firearm training, many law enforcement officers receive instruction in de-escalation techniques. For example, as of 2007, all operating personnel in the Portland Police Bureau must go through mandatory crisis intervention training. This training deals specifically with how to de-escalate situations involving the mentally ill or developmentally disabled. CHL holders are not required to go through anything like de-escalation training. The impulse to shoot first and ask questions later in an emergency situation situation can be a powerful impulse, and de-escalation training is essential to combat this tendency. If a dangerous situation arises in a classroom full of kindergartners, don't we want people and only people who are trained appropriately to de-escalate the situation? In the recent, I've got a couple of examples here that prove this point. In the recent Arizona shooting, a CHL holder, actually they can carry guns without a permit in Arizona, but a law-abiding citizen carrying a gun nearly shot the hero who subdued the gunman, Jared Lee Loughner. When Joe Zamudio, the permit holder, initially saw the scene, he almost shot Bill Badger, the 74-year-old retired Army colonel who had physically subdued Loughner. After the event, Joe Zamudio stated, "I could have very easily done the wrong thing and hurt a lot more people." In another example, after the Virginia Tech tragedy, a review panel was convened by the Virginia governor to analyze and review the situation. And here's an excerpt from that panel's findings. If numerous people had been rushing around with handguns outside Norris Hall on the morning of April 16th, the possibility of accidental or mistaken shootings would have increased significantly. The campus police said that the probability would have been high that anyone emerging from a classroom at Norris Hall holding a gun would have been shot. A study published in the 2009 Journal of American College Health surveyed 413 college and university campus police chiefs across the nation. 86% of study respondents disagree or strongly disagree with the statement that, quote, if students were allowed to carry concealed handguns on campus, it would prevent some or all campus killings. Fortunately, the vast majority of college campuses have policies that prohibit firearms on campus, and most campus police chiefs recognize that allowing college students to carry concealed firearms on campus would not prevent firearm violence on campuses, the study concluded. When dealing with crisis situations on school grounds, the safety of our children must come first. It is essential that only the most qualified and trained people respond. According to an article published in the New York Times, New York police statistics show that simply hitting a target, let alone hitting it in a specific spot, is a difficult challenge. In 2006, in cases where police officers intentionally fired a gun at a person, they discharged 364 bullets and hit their target 103 times for a hit rate of 28.3%. In 2005, officers fired 472 times in the same circumstances, hitting their mark 82 times for a 17.4% hit rate. If accuracy is this low for highly trained individuals, how can we expect people with little or no training to hit the correct target in a classroom full of young children? Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for having a public hearing on this concept. Prohibiting all guns on school campuses is an important safety measure that should be a no-brainer. Protecting our children should be our highest priority. Allowing untrained and unprepared individuals with loaded guns onto school grounds will not keep our children safe. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent Castillo, thank you for your testimony. I think there are three things in common with Thurston, Columbine, and Virginia Tech. Certainly the shooters all were not concealed carry weapon holders. They all three were essentially gun-free campuses, and the police were not able to respond in time to save any lives. Could you draw our attention to any incidents where a concealed weapon permit holder has ever harmed or threatened anyone on a school ground, a campus?
Chair Pozanski and Senator Whitsitt, I cannot point to a specific case, but I don't think we want to wait until that happens. I think our job as state officials is to be proactive and to make sure that we have really good safety, health and safety policies in place for our children so that we can prevent that from ever happening. And I think that, it goes right along with the role that we all have in our duty to have good safety laws that but put in place the conditions where we would not have to worry about that happening.
after just a follow-up comment.
Yes.
I have a different, quite a different perspective in that when you have someone who is bent on coming to a campus with a weapon, they most likely will. And if there are no counterparts on campus to prevent someone from killing people willy-nilly, that's what happened at Columbine, that's what happened at Thurston, that's what happened at Virginia Tech. So, right. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
All right, so what we're going to do is continue with people that are here on the informational part, making certain we get that out, and then we will proceed with the public testimony, and everyone will be able to testify on the concepts as well as the bills. And what we're going to do is our next panel will be Lori Weimer, Rebecca Lieveson, and Al Spencer. I think they may be in the room next door. So while they are coming to be assembled, see if they're coming. Dun, dun, dun. All right, why don't we go and if you could identify yourself for the record and then give us your perspectives on the concepts that you want to discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your record. Lori Wimmer, representing the 45,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, here today to speak about the concept related to an amendment to House Bill 2797. Excuse me, I'm out of breath. We just ran up the stairs. Which would give educators and law enforcement personnel another tool to help keep schools safer. We believe that the amendment strikes just the right balance between an individual's right to possess weapons and a school district's need to keep staff and students safe from violence in school. We know that overall school is the safest place for children from a statistical point of view, but occasionally violence does erupt on school premises. Too many of our young people have been harmed as a result, and I've brought with me two of our members representing both urban and suburban school districts who could talk more about that. We know that schools and colleges are not appropriate places for carrying, discharging, or otherwise making use of any kind of dangerous weapon. And just as airports and courthouses and other public spaces are becoming safe havens, we think schools and campuses should be safe havens as well. Our thanks go to policymakers who backed this amendment to keep our schools safer. And two provisions of this amendment that I'd like to particularly point out, the one that we have seen a concept of, is evidence of a well-thought-out way of striking this balance. First, no person who would otherwise be allowed to possess a firearm would be inconvenienced by this safety measure because he or she would still be allowed to have an unloaded weapon locked in the car on school property. So if they were there as a volunteer or for a parent-teacher conference or what have you, there would be no issue around what to do to dispose of the weapon before coming in the school. And second, because discovered weapons would be subject to confiscation, we believe that crimes and tragedies would be preventable because of this preemptive ability on the part of administrators. For all these reasons, we support an amendment to move forward, and we thank the committee in advance if you do choose to amend the bill to make our schools and campuses safer. And with that, I'd like to hand it off to...
Yeah, perfect timing.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a procedural question?
Yes.
What amendments are we talking about? We're receiving testimony on amendments that we haven't seen.
There's no amendments at this point for any of the three bills. I put some concepts together. Some people asked what those concepts were. I told them, and I'm not sure why they're referring to it as amendments. There are no amendments to any of these three bills.
Thank you for putting that on the record.
You bet. All right, so we're down to two-minute timing. Ms. Weimer, thank you very much. And let's see, who's next?
I'm Rebecca Levison. I'll be really quick. I'm a sixth-grade teacher from North Portland. I'm now serving as president of the Portland Association of Teachers, representing 4,000 teachers in Portland Public Schools. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm sure you've heard of the recent tragedies and violence that's been happening in Portland with Portland Public School students. Children are dying every day by gun violence, and this increase has really shaken up the community. It's shaken up the schools. I really, really just wanted to say that violence in student homes and neighborhoods and communities creeps into schools, and schools officials need a tool to be able to make sure that there are not loaded guns allowed in schools. I'm actually pretty shocked that companies, what Susan Castillo had mentioned, employers are allowed to prohibit guns in schools, or guns at their work site, but a school building can't. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me. Our teachers need this safety measure for themselves as well as for their students.
All right, thank you. Mr. Spencer, Al?
Good morning. My name is Al Spencer. I'm a government economics teacher at Twelton High School. And I've taught at Twelton High School for 16 years and have been in a lockdown situation three times in the past 10 years. We practice on a regular basis full building lockdowns. Our rooms are numbered, which is visible from the outside to police officers, to facilitate rescue and retrieval. We instruct students to remain quiet and outside the line of sight from our door windows. Each time we practice, students are somber and reflect on past tragedies around our nation and our state. No one takes the drills lightly, which is just the opposite from our fire drills, which are once a month. There isn't any bickering, joking, or horseplay. Our last lockdown occurred when two students dressed in full black coats were reported in the hallways of Twelton High School. The lockdown lasted over an hour and caused both students and parents a great deal of concern. Students are taught not to use cell phones so as to tie up necessary cell phone service within the area and allow police to communicate. Parents were anxious because they were unable to reach students. Students were subdued and patient but scared. Students that caused the lockdown were fortunately dressed in a threatening manner but not armed. Another recent incident involved students from another school cruising the parking lot for several minutes, going up and down the lot as if looking for something or someone. Luckily, our student resource officers were able to detain and arrest the individuals after searching their car and finding a club. Maybe we've been lucky, or maybe our vigilance and practice of lockdown drills have made our students more cautious and aware. Our resource officers do an excellent job of ferreting out contraband, weapons, and unwanted individuals on school property. I would support the concept to limit weapons on school property for the another source of protection for students at school. While it restricts the individual's right to carry a concealed weapon permit or not, it provides another level of security for students engaged in education. Schools should be a safe haven from the disruptions that surround every school community. Schools should be allowed to carry out their primary directive to educate students in a safe and secure climate. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the violence in Portland, to your knowledge, were any of those acts perpetrated by CDL holders?
No, not to my knowledge. But I didn't know if you could hear my testimony because you were actually speaking to the gentleman to your right there. So I don't know. I don't believe that. But I also don't believe that I'm just really shocked and surprised that concealed weapons would be allowed in a school building when teachers and students are in there working on their primary mission of educating students. I need to feel safe, and our members need to feel safe, and teachers need to feel safe, and students need to feel safe.
Just follow up. I mean, the point is, I'd suggest that the violence is coming from another segment of society, and that's where the focus should be.
All right, any other questions? Thank you very much. Our next panel is going to be Mike Hensman, Diane Holmes, and Mary Claire Buckley.
Thank you. My name is Mike Heinzman. I'm with the Oregon State Police Identification Services Section. I'm the operations manager here. We're here basically to answer any questions that the committee has on the current operation of our firearms instant check system in regards to how it operates in regards to mentally ill persons. Diane Holmes is our firearms manager, and Mary Claire Buckley is from PSRB. So,
all right. So we'll come back. I do have some questions, I suppose, but before I make any questions or comments, I'd like to just hear from the others as to specifically, I think one of the issues that, as one of the members had brought up, is what is the current process and procedure for someone who is seeking to have to purchase a gun retail as it pertains to someone that may have some type of mental health issues?
Okay, my name is Diane Holmes. I'm the firearms manager for Oregon State Police, Chair Przanski, and a committee. The current procedure purchasing retail would be that a purchaser would go into a retail operation, complete an ATF application 4473. At that time, the gun dealer would contact Oregon State Police to run a background check. They would be providing OSP with the purchaser information, the dealer information, the gun information, and possibly the Social Security number if the person chooses to give that to us, along with valid government-issued ID. After all that information is entered into our database, we will query 8 different databases, that being DMV, Oregon Wants and Warrants, Federal Wants and Warrants, Oregon Computerized Criminal History, Oregon Department of Corrections, Oregon Mental Health, the NICS Index, FBI III, which is the Interstate Criminal Identification Index, and we do a stolen gun check. Those 8 databases are queried. The responses come back within about 30 seconds. We review all the information on the criminal history and in all those databases to determine either federally or by state if the person is prohibited in any way from purchasing a firearm. If that person is in particular to the mental health issue, we have the Oregon Mental Health Database. If that person is prohibited, their name will appear in, from that response back that they are in that database. Only their name and date of birth as a pointer will be in there. There is no information that we will see as to what their medical history is. At that time, if their name is in that database, we will deny the transaction.
All right, we're going to come back.
Okay.
Mary Claire?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and I was asked to bring some information regarding persons with mental illness and how it relates to owning or purchasing a weapon. Currently under Oregon law, a person with a mental health or developmental disability would only be precluded from purchasing or possessing a gun if they have been found guilty except for insanity of a crime, have been civilly committed to the Oregon Health Authority, or have been found to be mentally ill and are subject to a court order that likely came out of a civil commitment hearing. So for the status of a person with mental illness, those are the only prohibitors. Now, persons with a mental illness also could be prohibited as a result of a legal status, and that is that, if a person is found, is convicted of a crime, is a felon, and happens to have a mental illness. That wouldn't have been the reason, you know, for the, but it's because, not of their mental illness, but because of the crime, then they too can be prohibited from possessing a weapon. Interestingly, under federal law, the prescription is greater. It also includes persons who have been found unable to aid and assist, and people who have been found to lack the ability to manage, to contract or manage their own affairs. So under federal law, those two categories also for persons with a mental health would be precluded from possessing a weapon. And so if the other qualifiers in the statutes under 166, if the person with a mental illness were, you know, either convicted, had an outstanding warrant, were on pretrial release, all those things that apply to any person in the criminal justice system would, but for purposes of solely the mental health status, it would be those three categories.
All right, thank you. Senator Cruz first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. I think I fully understand now. I mean, for a person's mental state to become a factor, they have to have been adjudicated, because before that, it's HIPAA protected, and there's nothing we could do to get access to the information, correct?
All right. I got Senator Bonamici and then back to Senator Wissett.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask Ms. Buckley, I missed one of the things that you said, that you said there are prohibited if found mentally ill by court order, guilty by reason of insanity, or what was the other?
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Bonamici, if they are found to be committed to the Oregon Health Authority, so civil commitment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned how quickly you can turn around these gun checks. However, I have in my records more than one detailed complaints where people who were trying to access your office during gun shows were unable to reach you, not for minutes, but for hours. Up to 5 hours, no one answered the telephone. Can you explain that?
Yes, Senator Winslet, Chair Pruszynski, and committee. In regard to gun shows, typically what has happened in the past, the expos, which are the biggest gun shows out there, used to be 3 to 4 times a year. Starting in 2010, the gun shows went to every month, which has substantially increased the amount of transactions that we are able to do in a day. In addition, recently, because of the climate in the nation, not only in Oregon but nationally, we've seen a substantial increase in sales. In Oregon, it's been anywhere from 14 to 18% increase over the last few months. That being said, that when we have multiple people calling in, we only have so many resources. We have 14 call takers and 2 lead workers, a manager, and a supervisor in our unit. During a gun show, we can have upwards to 1,200 transactions in one day. And you can well imagine that the amount of traffic going in and out of that phone system is incredibly high. We have some larger dealers that at times can tie up our phone resources for up to several hours with one or two call takers, making it very difficult for other dealers to get through. So we have tried to make some changes, and we are in the process of putting in a new phone system that will provide the dealers with the opportunity to not have to continue to call and get a busy signal, but will be able to get into the phone queue immediately. And I think the biggest change that is going to be very substantial is that we are going to a computer-based e-check system that will give the dealer the opportunity to go online, enter the same information that the call takers do, query the same databases that we query today. However, they won't see those responses, but if there's nothing on that person's criminal background that would prohibit that, or any of the other prohibitors, they could be issued an approval on the spot and given a unique identification number. They'll also have the capability of being able to enter multiple transactions at a time. And if there's something that is that needs to be looked at, one of our staff members will look at the record to make that determination. So that in itself will be able to speed up the process and help service all the dealers in a timely manner.
Yes. Actually, I understand your explanation. However, you must be aware that most people who are buying a gun retail at a gun show aren't going to wait 5 hours to find out whether they can get it, so the sale goes away. It's also my understanding that the federal check can be done almost instantaneously. I mean, it's like it's just they're almost never get a busy signal. They almost never have to wait, and there are and they're almost you know, just usually within 2 to 3 minutes, unless they find something of a problem, in 2 to 3 minutes that it's done. So, what is it that OSP is doing that takes so long, and what is it that OSP does that is so different than from the federal that that we need to continue to maintain this blockage of free trade?
I don't believe that it's anything that is done differently as far as procedures. Oregon does have more prohibiting requirements. However, the process is basically the same, but there is a difference in that with NICS, they have three different call centers throughout the nation that are on a contract basis. And so those calls come in from the different dealers that are not from point of contact states such as Oregon. And if there is nothing on the person's background check, they'll get an automatic approval. If there's something that needs to be looked at, it will go into the NICS unit, and it will be looked at by an examiner. So I think it's, you know, basically the difference is how they are able to utilize their federal funds, and that they're using contract people. In the state, we have the amount of staff that legislature allows us to have, and so we utilize them in the most efficient way possible.
One short follow-up.
Yes.
And can you tell me then, have you actually, has Oregon State Police looked at contracting this service out in Oregon so that you could be as quick as the federal people are?
No, we have not done that.
Thank you.
All right, the question I had, maybe for Mayor Claire and for Diane, regarding the system that we currently have in our state, have you all looked at other states as to what might be other conditions that they will look at or means of having people report? You know, specifically, as I think everyone in this room probably realizes, had an officer who was murdered this last Friday. We do understand that individual did go through the background check, did clear the background check, but we also know that apparently prior to at least the reports that we're reading about, that she had destabilized, and there may have been different indicators. I've been told that some other states, such as California, may have other means of alerting individuals that would be making these decisions to someone who is, let's say, currently at the time they may be trying to purchase a weapon, if they're in that type of state, that would be some indicator that could be provided to those who would be maintaining the databases.
Well, Chair Pruszynski and Council, the databases and the information that we enter into our databases is confidential, and we are unable to release that information to anyone other than speaking directly with the purchaser. I am not aware of any state having such a process where they would alert law enforcement or anybody else if they felt somebody was a danger or felt that they needed to do so.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Claire?
Chair Pruszynski, I have not had an opportunity to look at other states, but I do think that would require a statutory enactment.
All right.
Because of the...
I have one last question. If you had a retailer who was presented with a sale and the person presented to them and they just seemed like the person just wasn't quite there, and they but they run the check and everything is cleared, that they do not have any reason not, does that retailer have the right to not go through with the seller? I mean, of course they can say the seller not. What if any type of liability could they be facing if they chose, based on the person's presentation, that they appear to be, let's say, unstable at that time, to not go through with the sale?
I'm not prepared to answer that. That would really be a question. I think that would need to be deferred to ATF type of a ruling.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. All right. Our next panel is Dennis Toon, Jack Dempsey, and Barry Albertson. Jack, I tell you what, I'm going to have you wait since you can come back. I'm going to get someone else. Karen Twine, or Twain? Is Karen here? One other thing, we have two members have other meetings today. They're not leaving because they're not interested. They're very interested, but because of the duties, I know that I think Senator Wissett and Senator Cruz at some point will be leaving. Same thing with Senator Dingfield, had other obligations, so we have some flexibility of people coming and going, but everything is going to be recorded, and they can review the testimony. So whoever would like to get started, remember you're limited to 2 minutes.
Go ahead. Thank you, Chair Przanski, committee members. I'm Dennis Toon, Director of Security Services for Portland Public Schools. Superintendent Castile, Rebecca Levinson have pretty much conveyed the points I would have conveyed. Portland Public Schools, the superintendent, would support any change that would prohibit weapons under a concealed weapons permit, or CHL, on school district property. Not only is it making our staff and students safer, it makes our community safer. Throughout the nation, we've seen football games, basketball games, where parents, students, the community have become enraged and started riots over small calls that have gone the wrong way. Add weapons into that, and we have had weapons pulled at Portland Public Schools. None that have occurred resulted in violence. We actually had one about 7 years ago in the classroom because a parent became agitated at the way the staff member was talking about the consequences of a discipline action against a student. It resulted, in no criminal action, no injuries or anything, but there is the potential. When police respond, and we do have school resource officers at our sporting events as well as in our schools, so when police are responding, there, anybody with a weapon becomes a target. I heard him talk about training of law enforcement officers, and again, in an instance like that, that does come in as a factor to play. Our school walls, if you miss, it will go into a bullet, will go through potentially into another classroom and strike another student, another staff member, or anyone else. Again, Portland Public Schools would really fully support a change that prohibits weapons on school district property.
All right, thank you.
My name is Karen Twain. I'm a school administrator in Tiger-Tualatin School District. I'd like to testify in favor of Senate Bill 2797. In particular, the addendum that pertains to schools is an important one to me. I've been in the education field for 25 years and have been a school principal and administrator for 12 of those. Our biggest initiative has been to teach students how to be safe, kind, and responsible. As educators, we know that when kids feel safe, they can achieve more. Unfortunately, I've had to suspend or expel students for bringing weapons to school, ranging from small pocket knives to guns. In every case, the student with the weapon made another individual feel unsafe. Currently, guns are banned in schools, but there's an exemption for the adults who have concealed handgun licenses. Basically, there's a different standard for adults and our students under 21 years of age. I can tell you that adults with guns make people in schools feel equally unsafe. When I was an elementary principal, students would find or steal candy, toys, and money from teachers' purses and drawers. How they even knew that particular items were hidden away was beyond me, but somehow they had a knack for figuring these things out. I fear that the same thing would happen with guns. It would take but one time for a student to get their hands on a gun, and there would be a horrible mishap and consequently a public outcry. In my current position as director of alternative schools, I work with secondary students who are considered at risk. They need structure and clear boundaries. The idea that some people can bring guns to school and others can't is a difficult rule to understand. I can guarantee you that if they think that someone is bringing a gun to school, even legally, they will bring a gun illegally because they will not understand where the line is drawn. As an educator, safety is paramount to the school experience. Precautions are in place should a dangerous person come on campus. I would ask that guns not be allowed on school property under any circumstance. Thank you in advance for understanding the importance of the passage of this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barry Albertson. I'm a member of the Tiger Talton School Board. In the interest of brevity, I'll read this, and I apologize for that. I know you have a hard copy. I want to thank you for allowing me to come here before you this morning with my friend, Senator Ginny Burdick, who is also a public school advocate, to share with you my thoughts and to give you my impression of and support of House Bill 2797. Senators, you here as members of this Judiciary Committee have a decision to make that's classic.
Barry, we have your written testimony. I can't have you read it in the record. It's already part of the record. If you want to summarize a few points, that would be great. But it's part of the record, and I have a lot of people that need to testify, so I can't permit that.
Then I would simply echo and have you read my testimony that guns in schools are really a bad idea. People who have them in schools probably are not well trained to have them. What you would ultimately have is a shootout with what our generals consider collateral damage, and that would involve kids. I would certainly support your decision to withhold guns, loaded or unloaded, in public schools as an issue of policy. I thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you. Thank you.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to start calling up. I have some other people that are signed up under the informational hearing part. It appears that many of those individuals are individuals. There are a couple of lobbyists that have signed up. I could take that testimony now, or we could try to get the general public up. And so what I'm going to do is we're going to first start off with, I got one individual that signed up, said they traveled more than 100 miles, Nick Oliver. Nick, why don't you come on up? And is the gentleman next to you going to also testify?
Yes, sir.
Why don't you come on up and give me your name, please, sir?
Noah Yeager.
Okay. And then Rachel Lucas. Why don't you come up, and gentlemen, whoever wants to start off, give us your name and the testimony.
My name is Nick Oliver. I'm the executive director of Bike Pack. I represent over 130,000 motorcyclists, as well as I'm a disabled veteran from Oregon and a father of seven and grandfather of 15 and two halves. I got two kids that are pregnant. Oh, thanks a lot. I would like for you to support 2797 as originally written without the amendment. First of all, we need to have it clearly defined how a weapon is to be carried. This was overlooked, unfortunately, at the 2009 session. We're looking to have it corrected so that we can do things legally and without problems. The other part that I have a issue with is the handgun issue. All you're doing with this is punishing legal and responsible citizens. You're looking at what if. You can what if anything to death. And you can what if until the cows come home. It isn't going to change facts. We have never had a CDL or concealed weapon holder fire on a school child. It's not happened. And why are we looking for a problem where there isn't one? This needs to stop. We need to go back to common sense. You'll find that most people that are doing it, getting concealed weapons licenses, are not only trained, as I am, as being a disabled veteran. I was trained in weapons use, but a lot of people would say no because I didn't go through police training. Mine was much more comprehensive, and I would never shoot a child, although I have been tempted to strangle mine a couple of times, but I'm not going to shoot him. Thank you.
All right. As any parent at some point.
Chair Posansky and members of the committee, my name is Mel Yeager. I live in Albany, and I'm also representing Motorcyclists of Oregon. I am the Secretary Treasurer of Bike Pack. We are here in behalf of House Bill 2797 as originally proposed and passed through the House.
without amendments, it makes the sense that we asked for in the first place. It corrects the problem that was developed in the 2009 session and allows people the right to again carry firearms on motorcycles, ATVs, and snowmobiles when they're out hunting or off-road or whenever they want to do it. It clarifies the language, and it asks that this bill be passed as originally proposed. The other thing, of course, is the concealed weapons carry issue. As my colleague here stated, concealed weapon carrying licensed people are not the problem. They are not the problem. It's the people that do not have concealed weapons licenses that do cause the difficulties. The people that have concealed weapons permits can perhaps solve a problem when something happens, if they happen to be in the right place at the right time. But they should not be punished. They should not be put in a position of being outlaws just because they choose to have a weapon on them at a time when it may be inconvenient for someone else. It raises the question of, if I enter a school zone and I've got a concealed weapon on my person, do I have to stop my car, take it out, unload the weapon, put it in the trunk of the car to drive through a school zone? This is basically what they're asking. A school zone is a part of a school. I just don't think that's reasonable, and I think they need to leave the concealed weapons license issue alone. And I ask that you would consider that and make your decisions accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Rachel?
Yes, my name is Rachel Lucas, and I'm a little bit confused about this hearing process. I am here primarily to testify in favor of 2787. I've already testified, and you've heard most of my testimony, but I'm also concerned about this amendment to 2797. I'm hearing a lot of amendment language.
Let me try to set the record straight. There are no amendments pending on any of these three bills. If you were here previously, I talked about having 934. I said it wasn't ready for prime time. There are some amendments I had worked on with that particular bill. I believe what some of the people have referred to is the amendment that I was putting together, or the concepts within that amendment. That's all I know. I can tell you, unless someone here has an amendment that's been drafted for any of these three bills, the three bills that are currently before us are what passed out of the House that was referred to the committee. Concepts could become amendments, but there's no amendments currently pending for any of these three bills.
Well, it does seem rather clear that there's a very strong concept towards an amendment to disallow any guns on any school grounds, either college campuses or K-12, and I would like to speak a little bit about that, but I also do want to speak in favor of 2787, and
then
should this
speak.
All be now?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. First of all, the guns in schools, I'd like to point out that I do not believe that any CHL holders have, at this point, it is currently legal to have CHL holders carry on campuses and in school grounds. I do not believe that a single incident of a CHL holder has yet resulted in any injury or death, or even probably anybody knows that they were carrying. So I'm not sure that argument can really come to bear in any realistic way. I also want to point out that training, anyone who is in any kind of situation where there's actual shooting taking place, no one really knows how anyone is going to react. A lot of that is going to come down to instinct. There, I know I train at Threat Dynamics, and it is we train for school scenarios in there. That's one of the training things that they do. I'm not a law enforcement officer, so and law enforcement. I know that when I went through my Beaverton Police Academy training, the officer who was on the scene at the shooting. I think in Salem recently, Thurston's shooting, he almost shot a student himself. So it just happens. There's a lot of confusion, and it will come down to whoever's instinct is the most reliable in that circumstance. So you really can't say, because we don't know. So that's all speculative. And the myth that schools are safer because CHL holders are disallowed from carrying is just completely unfathomable to me. It's a nice thought, but it's just not true.
All right, I need you to wrap up, please.
Yes, and I understand that many other people had quite long testimonies, but I understand there are a lot of people here that threw me off a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions?
So I have no time to testify on behalf of 2787.
If we have time at the end of the hearing, you can come back up, but I need to ask other people who have come here just as you did to give testimony today. Next, thank you,
gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, thank you very much for your hard work.
Thank you very much. You bet. Thank you. I have William Dewey, Eileen Smith, and Wayne Brady. Who would like to start?
William Dewey, Taggart, Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senator Burdick referred to the likelihood that someone would cause more harm than good. I have a couple of examples just to the opposite of that. Shooting in December of 2007 at the New Life Church in Colorado Springs, where a member of the congregation with a concealed handgun license stopped a mass shooting by opposing a gunman who was significantly better armed than she was. And there was an incident at a church in South Africa, I believe, in recent years, where a member of the church also stopped a mass shooting by a gunman who came in with fully automatic weapons by simply producing his revolver and firing a couple of shots that I believe didn't even strike anybody, but managed to scare off the gunman. It appears that Senator Burdick would prefer that only highly trained law enforcement officers respond to school or church shootings. I would agree. I would love that to be the case, too. But unless we can hire enough cops to put one in every classroom, there's two options. One, to present no opposition to a mass shooter, or two, to present at least the opposition of someone who has been background checked and is a concealed handgun license holder.
All right. Before we go any further, I do want to go ahead and go through the formality of opening up public hearings on all three of these bills, 2787, 2792, and 2797. What we will be doing is all the testimony that has been heard will be incorporated into the public hearing perspective on all three of those bills.
Okay. And other than that, I would just like to request that you do pass 2787 and 2792 out of committee unamended. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And let's see.
Eileen Smith.
Eileen.
Live in Salem. I am here as myself. I do not have a concealed carry, but I have been trained in gun work. And one of the issues seems to be concealed carry. Concealed carry means it is concealed, you cannot tell, they are not waving it around, and you're carrying it on your person. It's not in your purse, it's not in your car, it's on your person. So please, let's remember those things. One of the issues, if this permit is public, is you've created two things. Villains steal guns. I did a Yahoo search. How do villains obtain guns? Best answer, they steal them. They will know where to go. It's the villains and the criminals that we are scared of. That's why the public wishes to carry. The other thing is, you now have those that don't have a concealed carry, an easy pick. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have some answers for some other questions that came up.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and have the other gentleman speak, and then we'll open the panel up for questions.
My name is Wayne Brady. I live in Salem, and I'm here in support of the CHL privacy. I think there's no good reason for that information to be public, and I can see a lot of bad reasons for it to be public. I think it's, you know, we've seen instances where people have signed petitions and people found out about it and harassed them. We've seen the same things for a lot of other activities where advocates who are maybe opposed to guns or something like that would maybe go after CHL holders if that information were public. So I think it's a bad idea to make it public.
All right.
I'm also testifying in favor of the reciprocity bill. I think that's a good thing. People ought to be able to protect themselves even if they're out of state, as long as they've qualified to be a concealed carry holder.
All right. Thank you very much.
May I follow up on his comment about the
reciprocity?
Thank you. One of the questions was, is what is the other states? Utah, who has other states that it covers, is much more stringent and has a higher level of training. The other side of that is if we have enough reciprocity, I hope I'm saying that right, you will then have people from other states bringing cash into this state so that they can get our concealed carry permit, which will then be able to let them carry. It's a way of making money for the state.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much. My next panel is going to be Jason Short, Rosemary Scott, and Ken Ewing. Thank you. Whoever you'd like to get started, if you give us your name first.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Jason Short. I'm an attorney in the Portland area, and I've helped several people, and I defend people with regards to firearms cases. I was a former prosecutor in Washington County for about 8.5 years before that. I just wanted to come and just speak with you on my opinions with regards to the three issues. One is the reciprocity. I should also note that I'm an NRA-certified pistol instructor, and I also teach the concealed handgun classes here in Oregon. I've represented individuals that are CHL members with regards to having issues with reciprocity, members that live in Vancouver, Washington, for example, but work here in Oregon. It's a big inconvenience for those individuals when there's not reciprocity between our two neighboring states and two very close cities. It causes a lot of problems and inconvenience for a lot of law-abiding citizens. I also wanted to express my concerns with regards to the CHL holders and schools. As basically being in law enforcement for almost a decade, for about 8.5 years, I never prosecuted any cases saw cases up in Washington County in the Portland area with individuals involved with concealed handgun licenses in any schools. My mom's a middle school teacher here at Houck Middle School in Salem. She is a concealed handgun license holder. And she, as we've talked on many of occasions, she and even among her coworkers and school and teachers in that school have not expressed any concerns with regards to her and her having a CHL. In fact, it's been quite the opposite in her experience with other teachers, knowing that she's a concealed handgun license holder, that it's more of a deterrent, and also that there's safety there with regards to knowing that there's someone there, that in the event if something were to happen, a resource officer is not going to be there necessarily. He's not there all the time. Sometimes doesn't arrive there until late in the morning, or doesn't stay there the entire day. And so to have someone that's trained to be able to react, I think is a big deterrent factor. To say that now these are free zones, I think individuals, especially middle school and high school individuals, it could be... it could just open up a situation where they might want to say, hey, now that there's no school or there's no guns there, I might be tempted to go in there and do something.
Right. So thank you for your testimony. Go right ahead.
My name's Ken Ewing. I have submitted written testimony, but I wanted to comment on some things that I've heard already here today. Partially, again, on the topic of guns in school, or CHL holders being able to carry in schools. It seems to me that there's sort of almost an apples and oranges arguments that I'm hearing. There's one side who sees the gun itself as the bad thing, and we've got to keep guns out of school, and another side that says it's not the gun, it's who's holding it. And so I think we would all agree that having, you know, high school students packing guns would not be desirable, and that's illegal under current law. But the prohibition of CHL holders carrying on school grounds, to me, is an example of straining gnats and swallowing camels. It's focusing the attention on the people least likely to be the problem, and it does nothing about the people who are most likely to be the problem. I think the discussion here today about mental health issues is much more a topic that focuses on where there is room for something to do that will benefit. Each one of the attackers, say, in Virginia Tech, in Tucson, even Kip Kinkle in Springfield, clearly had severe mental health issues that people noticed for many months or years in advance. But I don't want the mental health issues to turn into a witch hunt. You know, I myself, back in the decade of the 90s, I've had a breakup with a relationship, decided I wanted to do counseling. You know, on and off for 10 years, I did counseling. I was never depressed. I was never on medication. I was never violent. But I learned a lot about myself that has made me a better person today. That kind of counseling should not be a factor in determining gun ownership or a CHL holder. I would want any work on mental health issues to make sure it doesn't turn into a witch hunt for minor issues.
All right, thank you, Ken.
Rosemary?
Yes. My name is Rosemary Scott. I'm a citizen here who would like to talk about 2787, prohibiting a public body from releasing information that identifies holders or applicants for concealed handgun. When I filled out my request for a concealed handgun permit, it asked for information that I wouldn't want released to the public, namely my address and my social security number, my telephone number, etc. The people who gave a report about my stability. I'm nervous, but I'm fine. I think that we have a right to protection of our ID, and the fact that I have handguns in my home, it should be said that those that are looking for a gun to use in the commission of a crime will have a blueprint or a shopping mall of where they can go to find a gun, which puts me more at risk, I think, than than the public having a right to know that I have a permit. And that's mainly what I wanted to testify about.
Well, thank you for coming forward. Question, Senator Bonamici first.
Thank you. Yes, I have a quick question for Mr. Short. You talked about the reciprocity issue between Washington and Oregon. Can you compare, please, the training requirements between those two states?
Can only speak for myself and on the training that I provide here in Oregon. I don't know of anyone that teaches the CHL classes up in Washington State, but I am familiar that, I mean, at least it's, I know it's similar with regards to what they teach, especially if it's an NRA certified pistol instructor. That's universal throughout the 50 states. So if they receive that training, it's going to be the same training that I received with regards to being able to teach that class.
Can I ask a follow-up?
You may.
So does Washington have a training requirement to get a concealed handgun license?
Yes, it's my understanding they do.
All right, thank you all very much for coming forward. All right, everyone else that's here, I've gone through the list of people who have registered to give testimony. The people I still have on the list are either lobbyists for various interest groups or a couple agency people. And so what I first want to do is those who are here that are here as an individual, is there anyone else here that would like to give testimony that may not have signed up on any of the list so we can make certain you have an opportunity to speak today, you would not have to come back because it looks like we're going to be coming back next week to complete our testimony.
come forward.
I'm signed up to speak. Well, I came here with Ceasefire Oregon, but I'm not speaking on behalf of Ceasefire Oregon. I'm speaking as an individual.
Okay, please come forward. We have a few more minutes, and then what we're going to do is we're going to figure out which day next week we will continue. It will probably be Tuesday or Wednesday in my discussions with the office manager. And if you'll put your name on the record, please, and tell give us your testimony.
Yes, my name is Diet Waleed. I live in Northeast Portland, and I have been a teacher in junior highs, middle schools, high schools, and I now am teaching a class at Portland State University on the issue of violence. In my class, we study violence in our culture and what to do to change it. And I remember Columbine, I remember Thurston, I remember a six-year-old child in Michigan who came to school with a loaded gun that he got at home and killed a former a fellow student who was also 6 years old. I remember Virginia Tech, and a few months ago, a friend of mine buried her grandson because he was shot and killed on the streets of Portland. I'm concerned primarily about the issue of the guns in schools. Any guns in schools, I think, are a danger to staff, to students. One of the resources that we use in my class is a book called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. And it's about how boys, particularly in inner city, learn how to be tough and learn how to prove their manhood, first by using fists, but then progress on to sticks and knives. And at the level of knives, the violence is still somewhat controllable. But when it gets to 13-year-olds having access to guns, then it's totally out of control. These are 13-year-olds with no supervision, and it makes them feel powerful. It gives them a rush to have a gun. That's a dangerous situation in any place, and certainly in our schools. Martin Luther King tells us about the moral arc of the universe bending toward justice. And my friend, Reverend Rick Skidmore, says, yes, the moral arc of the universe does bend, but it bends because each one of us puts our hand on the moral arc of the universe and bends it toward justice. You, as the committee members today, have an opportunity to put your hand on the moral arc of the universe and bend that moral arc more towards justice to protect our students.
All right. Thank you very much for coming forward. First, let's see if there's any questions. Thank you again.
Thank you.
I want to thank everyone for being here today. I want to thank everyone for being very civil and hearing the debate and the discussions. As I said, we will be continuing our, based on the people who have signed up today, we'll be coming back. It appears that this next Tuesday, will be the day we will continue. It looks like on that day we have three bills that are currently scheduled for that day that are not involved with what we're discussing today. I will check with the council that for that day, more than likely what we will do, we will begin where we've left off with these three bills and the concepts. So I want to thank you all very, very much for being here. Colleagues, anything else that we need to do for today? If not, then we ourselves will be back on Monday at 8:30, but this hearing will be continued till the following day, this next Tuesday. Thank you very much, and we're adjourned for the day.